Welcome to the Dark Mind Podcast. Friends and familiars, thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Dark Mind Podcast, where we explore the boundless realm of dark literature and film. On today's show, we have a writer of dark speculative fiction. His short stories span the gamut of time, history, and the human experience. He's joining me today to discuss his recent short story collection, Death in Small Doses. So without further ado, join me as we delve into the dark insight of Chance Noir. Chance, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Vince. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Thank you for joining me on this 25th day of February 2024. I came across your work via Bookstagram and was really intrigued by the title of your book, Death in Small Doses. Upon reading it, I found an immersive collection of short stories dealing with the beauty, heartbreak, and minutiae of death from multiple different viewpoints, perspectives, geographical areas, and time periods. I was really impressed with your use of metaphor, allegory, and literal references to historical events to produce this dark, surreal work. So I'm happy to have you on the show and eager to get into the details of this work.
Grateful to have this.
Well, so as I mentioned, the book is a collection of short stories that deal with multiple elements and multiple guises of death. I'm a big proponent of the philosophy of Stoicism, and one of Stoicism's primary tenets is the concept of memento mori, being mindful of death. What are your thoughts on death, the afterlife, and what was your inspiration for writing a book centered around these concepts?
Well, death is the big mystery. Everybody seems to be worried about it, but a lot of people fail to realize that we are basically energy, and the law of energy is it can't be created nor destroyed, so who knows what happens after you die.
How does that song go? We are stardust. We are golden.
Yep. We are golden. Exactly.
Closed out Woodstock. What's her name? Joni Mitchell.
Jesus Christ.
Well, there is an opening salvo of a story about a king named Peorici, who is deep in the throes of his kingdom being at war and having to make some devastating decisions to keep his family from suffering. But then the story takes a comedic turn. What tone were you trying to set for the collection with this opening story?
Well, when I was writing it, that was going to be a much longer story. I had the battle scene all in my mind, so I wanted to get that out first. Because a lot of my books, I will write the ending first.
Mm.
So then I had that, and then I wrote the line from one of the surrounding hills, "Death gazed down upon the scene below." And it's like, well, no, death is an act, the act of dying. So then in my mind, you know, I had this argument with the actual goddess of death, you know, it's like bantering back and forth. And my wife said, no, I love it. Leave it. She said, this is actual genius.
Yeah.
So the story just ended there.
Okay. Well, the beginning of the opening salvo contains the quote, "I am become death, destroyer of worlds," from the Bhagavad Gita, which was quoted by Oppenheimer upon the first test detonation of the atomic bomb. There is a lot of interplay in the stories in the collection between human characters and a seemingly human incarnation of death. Were you attempting to address in any way our ability to become the architects of our own extinction? And could you expand on the concept of using death in a personified form in your stories?
Oh, I think that we are actually the architects of our own demise. It's like it's going to happen. Just when it does is the big mystery. As far as personifying death, people fail to realize that death is actually around us each and every day. You know, trillions of life forms are born and die every minute of the day, and they go unnoticed. So death is therefore an afterthought. So I just kind of wanted to bring it into the forefront.
Do you ever listen to the Lex Fridman podcast?
I actually heard it once, and it's like, I want to hear more.
So whether you listen to it audio only, it's actually best to listen to it on YouTube or Spotify for the video. He's got a really nice setup, great audio. But his most current episode is Dana White from the UFC. But just before that is a woman by the name of Annie Jacobson. She's a investigative reporter, and she goes into detail about who has nukes, how many they have, what each individual power has to do to get the, you know, like who's authorized to just let those go into the atmosphere, and how the whole thing would play out as far as nuclear winter. Man, like the first 15 minutes of this podcast will make you shit your pants.
It's pretty, oh, yeah.
It is insane.
I saw a model of that when I was younger, and it's like, wow. The first 10 minutes are really going to suck. And after that, no one's going to be around.
Well, I mean, depending on where you are, that's the horrible part. Depending on where you are, you could still survive it. But then comes nuclear winter and the famine. You will starve to death.
You will starve.
Or it'll probably turn into a Mad Max-like scenario where there'll be like cannibals and you'll be marauding gangs roving around.
The model I saw said that, you know, it would be like what? 15 or 20 years of no sun.
Oh,
the earth will plummet into sub-zero weather, so nobody's going to survive that.
Yeah. Oh, God. Well, moving on. I mean, I guess this is the dark... This is the Dark Mind podcast. I mean, we're not here to talk about fluffy things, but like our own nuclear extermination is really like...
We're all gonna die.
I don't know if I want to get quite that dark. So we'll try to keep it light dark, whatever the hell that means. Anyway.
Lighter shades of gray.
Lighter shades of gray. There you go. Well, the first story, The Oracle of Detroit, which is the overarching narrative of the book, is so good. The dark setting of New York and the surreal hellscape that the protagonist Jasmine is thrust into as her call of adventure is really immersive. When it came to world building for this story, did you have an experience in these locales to build from, which would include Jasmine's references to her previous living situations in New Delhi, Bangkok, and Tokyo? And do you think it's necessary to have firsthand knowledge of locales to effectively portray them in a fictional setting?
Not necessarily, but I believe it really helps. While I've never been to India, Thailand and New York, definitely. So they're very, very busy places. Tokyo is unreal. A friend of mine had actually been to New Delhi, and so we compared notes, and yeah, I missed a complete circus there. So.
Yeah, how was Tokyo?
Oh, if you like people, you'll love it. If you don't like people, it's a nightmare.
Is it that it's heavily populated, or is just everything is just bunched together?
It's both. It's heavily populated, and everything's bunched together, and it is sensory overload. Seriously. It's like, if you're introverted, you might as well just stay home.
Yeah. Yeah. I find it to be a very interesting place, but I've never been there. I'm only going by movies I've seen. And I know, yeah. I don't know if he lives in Tokyo. Are you familiar with the writer John Athon?
No, sir.
Yeah, he lives in Japan. I don't know if he lives in Tokyo, though. It wouldn't surprise me if he did. But yeah, Japan just period really interests me. The history of the samurai and...
Oh, they have a fascinating culture.
Yeah, the culture. Exactly. Yeah. Well, the story, as I alluded to, is about a young woman named Jasmine who is attending university in New York and is obsessed with history, which ties into her ultimate fate later in the story. The concept of an oracle, usually depicted as a wise sage, is a staple of the hero's journey. And I love the way that in your story, you, in a sense, make the oracle the hero. Myth and ritual provide catharsis to the masses. So what do you think the concept of an oracle provides for a story about an epic struggle? And what did you want to accomplish by putting the oracle at the center of that struggle?
Well, that comes from the old saying, you know, with great knowledge comes great power.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, she basically receives the ultimate knowledge. So she has all the power in the world to do what she wants to do. And she could pass that on to other people and say, you know, you need to do this, you need to do that, wait for a hero that's never going to arrive, when in all actuality, she could be the hero.
Mm-hmm. And doesn't that saying continue, or is it a separate one? With great power comes great responsibility? Is that how it goes?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so her responsibility, how would you outline that with the power that she receives?
Well, basically, she ends up being the next oracle.
Mm-hmm.
So she can actually view the mistakes of the past. And like they say, history repeats itself. If you know the past, then you basically know the future.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can sidestep some certain issues, why not go for it?
Yeah. Well, now, there are two characters in the book named Ragnar and his wife, Lagertha, who have to be modeled after two historical Viking figures. And from the little bit that I read, I wasn't quite sure if these are historical figures or legendary. What did you find out about these figures in your research, and what inspired you to use them in your story?
Ragnar and Lagertha, they were actual real people. Ragnar Lothbrok was the king of Kattegat, was one of the original invaders of England.
Okay.
Actually, his son fought the last Viking battle in England, but it came about from the Viking legends: when you die, you go to Valhalla. So I researched more and more and found this obscure text, which I only read just the one text, and I cannot find any more about it, that said that, you know, Odin would approach certain warriors and send them back to Midgard, you know, Earth, to complete a quest, and as a reward they were given an extra life on Earth before they returned. So these two characters, they're actually in a work in progress I have right now, which is a beast. So it's kind of like, you know, I'm taking these two characters from a future work and kind of melding them into this story.
Gotcha. Yeah, I love Norse mythology. Odin sacrificing himself to himself, hanging from the great tree Yggdrasil to discover the secrets of the runes.
Sacrificing an eye for all knowledge.
Yeah, and Valhalla, I mean, it's weird how in different cultures, their religions have different ideas of what heaven is. Valhalla is endless war throughout the day, and I'll party at night, and then endless war. Then, I mean, just war and sex and drinking. Like, wow, that's a hell of a heaven concept you have there.
The original sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Fuck yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of Norse mythology. If you haven't noticed, my podcasting last name is Midgard because I'm here on Earth and I want to connect with the gods.
We all do.
Oh yeah. Well, when Jasmine finally reaches her destination, what you think would be the end of the story is actually the beginning. And when it came to the way you wove the stories within stories and intertwined characters, was there a meticulous outlining involved, or are you one of those people who is just able to pants a complex story with a little editing at the end? And can you tell us a little about your process in that regard?
Like I said, you know, I usually start off with the end of a story. I know where I want to be, and then I work to the beginning and then figure it out as I go during the middle.
So you start at the end and just kind of backtrack to the beginning?
I'll start at the end. I know exactly how I want the story to end. And so then I need a beginning. So then I'll get a beginning and then just kind of trail it along until it meets the end.
So you see this climax of a story, but you don't know who the characters are, how they got to where they got. You're just like, epic battle between a horned god and a human warrior from, you know, wherever. Like, you have this epic climax, but you don't know who these people are, what their names are, where they came from, and then you got to figure out the beginning to the story?
Yeah. Well, there you go. Pretty much the first story, it was going to be the end of the story I had. So I needed a beginning and a middle, and it's like, nope, it's the whole story.
Okay. Interesting. Well, the next story, Kiss of Death, is an epic tale about a king named Boan who had an unquenchable bloodlust and was the embodiment of a warrior king. He has very close interaction with a female embodiment of death named Zanlua, who wore a very specific item of clothing that had very specific ties to the machinations of life and death. And I was unable to find a reference to this character, so I was wondering if you could shed some light on her creation and depiction as a female.
She's actually an amalgamation of quite a few myths and mythologies, and mainly Atropos, who snipped the lives of people from the fabric of time, and the Morrigan. There were the two of the main ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where she came about. And then I just kind of threw in some extra tidbits here and there from other myths.
So who was the god that you said snipped people from the fabric of time?
Atropos. She was one of the three fates.
Okay. Snip from the fabric of time as in they die?
Yeah, she snipped the lives.
Okay, you know, like, gotcha.
Because, you know, basically your life is a thread in the tapestry of time.
Yeah.
So she would snip your life to end you. So I kind of bastardized that.
I'm not a religious person myself, but I love studying religion and the poetic way that people personify concepts. Like, I'm not Catholic, Christian, anything, but God damn it, if I wouldn't love to go into the Sistine Chapel, you know?
Oh, me too.
Yeah, especially like, I don't know, is Hinduism primarily from India?
As far as I know.
As far as its origins, I feel like it may have begun somewhere different.
Maybe Central Asia?
Yeah, but man, you talk about a rich mythology. I don't know how many gods they have, but they have all different disciplines. The one that interests me the most is their left-hand path variety, Shaivism. They worship the god Shiva, the destroyer. And I don't know if you're familiar with CERN, where they have the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva, Switzerland, where everybody was terrified they were going to create a black hole that was going to suck the universe in.
I remember that, yeah.
India gifted them a statue of Shiva that is right outside that building, their main, I guess, administration building.
Yeah. So when it happens.
Yeah. Anyway, circling back to the book, in the story, all the characters are mythical, but seem to be myths that were created by you. So when it comes to what you read yourself, do you read a lot of fantasy? And what do you think predisposes you to being able to write such fantastical characters and creatures?
Oh, I grew up reading tons of fantasy. Terry Brooks, Robert Jordan. Oh, man. I cut my teeth on Terry Brooks.
Yeah.
And that man can build a world from scratch to where you believe it.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, I can see that mountain. Yes, I see that tree.
You know, I don't think I've ever been much on fantasy, but I'm really starting to like dark fantasy. It kind of started when I read Garrett Godsey's book, The Rivener. And then most recently, I read Sabrina Vorman's book, Ashen Heart. And I'm about
to read that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm about to start on one by, I hope I'm not butchering her name, Ligia Cushman, book one of the Mosa Chronicles. It's supposed to be a dark fantasy. So yeah, I'm kind of digging it. I'm not big on, like, I don't know what you would call it, normal fantasy, generic fantasy, but, you know, fantasy with a dark aesthetic, dark subject matter. I feel like I've been missing out on that. A little bit of contempt prior to investigation.
That's what a lot of my friends say. You don't believe in a happy ending, do you? I believe it exists somewhere, just not in my writing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's just not what I find compelling. I grew up watching movies and reading books that had happy endings. I got that all out of my system in my in my midlife and later on. I guess maybe I've grown cynical with old age. I just want everybody to be miserable. Well, in part two of the story, you begin with a quote from Mark Twain. And this is so salient. I don't think I'm ever going to get another tattoo, but if I was about 10 years younger, I might consider getting this tattooed on me. I do not fear death. I had been dead for billions and billions of years before I was born and had not suffered the slightest inconvenience from it. So it's interesting to me to think that we spend so much time thinking about what happens after death, that the prospect of just returning to the state of nothingness we existed in before we were born doesn't seem as inconceivable as, you know, most people make it out to be. Like, it seemed like it would be like the natural, like, well, yeah, I guess I didn't exist before. I guess I'm not going to exist after. Like, I mean, I guess it's a sense of self-preservation that makes people want to not only create, but then believe in an afterlife. What was your inspiration for using that quote? And what are your thoughts on the proposition of an afterlife?
Well, it's like you said, everyone's concerned of what happens after you die, but no one even gives a thought what happens before you're born. I mean, you know, I asked a friend of mine who read that same quote. He asked me about that. I said, oh, you remember World War II? And he goes, no, I wasn't born yet. So do you remember it? He goes, no. I said, there you go.
I mean, in the defense of him and anybody you would give that quote to or explain that concept to, it is kind of unnerving. Like, yeah, I didn't exist before, but I exist now. You're telling me I'm going to go back to just not existing? It is a scary proposition, whether it be something conscious or whether it's just part of our programming. So I'm not necessarily like, oh, the fact that people think that is ridiculous. I'm just saying, like, the thought that it's possible that you just go back to nothingness never crossed your mind. You know, who knows? There may be heaven and hell. And I don't know, hell sounds like it's a lot cooler than heaven. I think hell sounds much more like Valhalla.
Remember, they don't have whiskey in heaven, so.
Yeah. Yeah, have you read any of Aaron Lewis's books?
On my list. I have so many I want to read.
She's like a secular humanist atheist, so her nonfiction as well as her fiction reflects that, and she wrote a book called South of Heaven that I read, that a woman dies, she gets into heaven because she does that deathbed confession. Like,
oh, okay.
Her mom was like a hardcore Christian. So she's like, what if she was right? So she like cries out to God and makes it in by the skin of her teeth. And St. Peter is pissed because, you know, like he's reading through the Lamb's Book of Life. He's like, you have been a whore and a thief. And he's like, but right before you died. Yeah. Right. So he ends up having to let her in. It's funny. She's got a wicked sense of humor. Well, the next story, The Ferryman, tells the story of a man named Manfred Lutz, who, based on his heroic act, was tasked with helping a young woman that he had saved let go and accept death, essentially acting as a mythical ferryman. The concept of the ferryman is present in many religious and mystical traditions, with It's not exact, but it's kind of in the realm, Papa Legba being an example that I really love.
That's a great one.
Yeah. Some traditions even go so far as to bury the dead with coins to pay the ferryman for safe passage to the other side. So what is it about the concept of a mysterious figure that takes you over a dark body of water that seems to give closure to the act of death?
It's the parental figure, especially the father. You know, the mother brings you forth from the abyss into life. So because most of the figures are male, it would be the father figure to escort you out of this world into the next.
Oh. So you're saying it's kind of a metaphor for rebirth?
Pretty much, yeah. Because all the religions that have basically the ferryman are taking you from this life to the next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just don't disappear. You cross the River Styx, you know, to the next shore, which is basically, you know, what happened in a lot of mythologies.
Mm-hmm. But the River Styx, why would you need to cross the River Styx if Achilles' mother dipped him in the River Styx and it made him impenetrable? I would think I'd want to get in that goddamn river. You know? I'd swim.
Oh, we don't have that kind of time.
Oh, God. I'm sorry. Listeners at home, I apologize. I will move on. But the next story, The Death of Innocence, is about a detective named Joseph Geist who finds himself on the trail of a very intelligent, clever, and crafty serial killer. What's weird is this serial killer still lives with his mother, resides in filth, and is basically a bottom-feeding sex addict. So what led you to design his character with such low IQ living habits, yet make him so incredibly intelligent?
Oh, well, it's a singular intelligence. I likened him to a savant.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up, I knew a gentleman who basically worked in a garage, an auto garage, and he did menial labor. Every now and then he'd change tires, but mainly he'd clean up and take out the trash. And he had the mentality of a child, basically, but he could beat every grandmaster in chess.
Wow.
It astounded people.
That is insane. Yeah, I mean, it's not hard to imagine because I've seen people that are savants, like very low functioning socially, that actually are basically nonverbal, if I remember correctly. There was this one kid, I think he was early teens, like 14, 15, something like that, could play the piano like you would not believe. And I mean,
oh, yeah.
But you know, I don't know that I would liken, and you know, this is not based on any sort of education. This is pure speculation on my part, but I don't know if I would liken the mechanics of playing a piano to the mechanics of the intense abstract reasoning involved to play chess, especially to play it well. What do you think?
I don't know. Like I said, people said that he was a savant when it came to chess, but there had to been some incredible knowledge in there somewhere because he had to do complex moves and think, you know, 20, 30 moves ahead of time. But you talk to him and then half the time he couldn't remember seeing you last week.
So when you say grandmaster, are you being hyperbolic or do you mean literally he's playing some high level people?
No, he played some high level people.
Okay. So more than just the guys that are really good that meet up at the Starbucks every Wednesday, like he was.
From what I understood, he had people coming in from other countries to play.
What?
Yeah.
And he couldn't secure some sort of monetary. Well, yeah. I was going to say, like, surely that would be worth some sort of sponsorship or money to where he wouldn't have to do menial labor in a garage. But I don't know. Mm-hmm. Maybe it kept him busy.
Don't know.
Well, circling back to the book, the story Blind Date is about a man named Aaron who is a successful businessman and an eligible bachelor. He can have his pick of any woman, not just because of his wealth, but also because he has the looks to go with it. However, through a fateful encounter with a mysterious woman, he's brought to account for the transgressions he's committed, and there is a very salient quote towards the end that states, "You had to believe you were getting everything you've ever wanted, so it would hurt that much more when I took it away." It made me think of the concept of fuck you money, which doesn't really exist as far as I'm concerned, because the more you have, the more you have to lose. So what message were you trying to convey with this statement in the story?
Oh, Aaron was my buddy. Oh, I had to go some dark, dark places in my mind to create Aaron.
Yeah. Tell me about them.
He was the quintessential player. He was the quintessential con man. He would take a woman and just totally use and abuse her. Actually, the opening quote from that story was from one of the other characters. It was his coworker, Sandra Templeton. Her quote was, "I've considered that perhaps hell exists only in the mind, and then I met you."
Well put. I'm trying to remember, how did he get lured into that room?
He was lured there by a beautiful woman who played him. I've had people tell me they love that story.
Yeah.
Well, every woman I know told me she loved that story. I love that story.
Yeah. The end. Yeah. The comeuppance, I'm sure. Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. Well, your story, Demon's Den, is about a man named Lieutenant Schlesinger and takes place during the Tet Offensive in the Vietnam War. And like Manfred Lutz, he goes against the objectives he's given in a war he no longer agrees with and does something heroic. And when it comes to covering their tracks, Schlesinger quotes Napoleon by saying, "History is a set of lies agreed upon." And being a person who I'm sure has studied history to write these stories, what are your thoughts on the accuracy of what we believe to be history and what we believe to be propaganda and lies from the other side?
Oh, I would be willing to bet that half of history is nothing but propaganda, if not more.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. When I was younger, I spoke with a gentleman who served under Patton in World War II, and he said that actual events pale in comparison to obtaining the narrative to the story. I thought that was so profound because, you know, everyone knows all the atrocities that were committed by the Nazis. Yes. I said, yes. And he goes, "Who wrote those?" We did. He goes, "Yeah. Do you know all the atrocities that the Allies committed?" Well, I'm assuming there were some, but do you know any of them? No, I really don't. He goes, "You ever wonder why?"
Yeah.
Well, I do now.
We tend to turn a blind eye to our own issues. I mean,
yeah.
Some people would say, well, you're being unpatriotic if you examine those. But I don't know if it has anything to do with patriotism. I mean, you can be dedicated to your country, but still hold particular people accountable for, you know, things like war crimes.
Yeah. Truth is truth, no matter, you know, who tells it.
Yes, indeed. Well, the story, The Chameleon, was a very quick one. How was that story meant to affect the pacing and progression of the book?
Well, there was a longer story before, and I had a longer story after. So I wanted a short one just to kind of break it up. And in all honesty, when I wrote that, I told it in as few words as I could possibly do it as an exercise.
Okay.
So could it have gone longer? Sure. Would I have dragged it out? Yes.
Well, your story, and I've always wondered, is it spécial du jour? Is that how you...
Spécial du jour.
Okay, well, your story, spécial du jour, is about a woman named Christelle that trained to be a chef and eventually opened her own 3-Michelin-star-rated restaurant, but she is plagued by her deviant younger brother. And the concept of the enabler and tough love is brought up in the story. And despite the tragic circumstances, the story has a very satisfying ending. Is the satisfaction more from the agency that Christelle exhibits or the particular type of revenge that she takes? Because I'm sure, like Blind Date, all of your female readers took a special liking to the ending of this one as well.
Yeah, they did. Not as much as Blind Date.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. No, they liked it, but not as much. I wanted him to die.
Yeah, her brother was a scumbag, but he seemed like he was only really hurting one woman as opposed to Aaron, who was just ruining the lives of many women.
Right. Well, I believe that, you know, whether it's intentionally or unintentionally, we are all enablers in some form or another until you either recognize it or just get fed up with it. So with Christelle's ending, it's like she just got fed up. And it's like, I can't do this anymore. You've ruined your life, and now you're basically ruining mine. So there was some tough love needed.
Indeed. Well, the final story, A Nameless Boat, exemplifies the full circle of one generation giving way to the next. And it seems, at least in my experience, that there is animosity between generations instead of respect. Like, I'm sure you've probably heard the derogatory statement, whatever, boomer. You
know? Oh, yeah.
Which I guess that's usually Gen Xers saying that. I don't know. I think some millennials say that, too.
Oh, I think everybody under 50 says it.
Yeah, okay. Why do you think that animosity exists?
It has existed throughout time, and it will exist until the end of time, because every following generation inherits everything the previous generation passes on, including all the problems, which seem to be growing exponentially.
If you don't mind me asking, what generation are you?
I'm Gen X.
You're Gen X. Okay. Yeah, I guess, I don't know. I just, for some reason, I mean, you know, I'm not the most observant. I'm pretty singularly focused myself. I might be a serial killer.
Hey.
No, I love the podcast too much. I don't have time to be a killer. But if I didn't have the podcast, who knows? No, I'm just kidding. I'm not
kidding. Knows?
But
squandered possibility.
Right? So much joy to spread. I guess, I don't know. It's just not something that I've ever noticed until, of course, I got older. But I guess that makes sense. It's like once you're giving way to the next generations, then you start noticing the dynamics between yours and the one that you were raised by. So, yeah, it's an unfortunate thing because, you know, my parents taught me to respect your elders when you were younger. You know, of course, not if they're abusive. You know, obviously, you don't just respect somebody because they're your elder. But, you know, as long as they're not causing you any harm, you respect them. It's just kind of weird to see like some kid with a face tattoo and a vape, you know, talking to a like a 70-year-old man, like, whatever, boomer.
One of my favorite videos, oh my God, I just love this video to death. I must have saw it like 30 times. Mm-hmm. Guy in the gas station is basically harassing this older guy, and this older guy just put the beat down on him.
Oh, Lord.
It's like, and that's because he grew up that way. You know, you get a boo-boo and you got to get a Band-Aid.
Yeah.
Please put spit and dirt on it. Went on our way.
Yeah, I remember, I forget who it was. It was one of my friend's dads growing up. He's like, if you start some shit with me, I will kill you. I'm too damn old to fight. I can't, I don't have any endurance. I will kill you. Like, all right, fair enough.
My dad actually told that to me one time. He says, you know, I'm too old to go 15 rounds. I'm going to kill you in the first.
Yeah. 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 I think that's a common saying.
Okay.
Well, great book. Listeners,
thank you.
Buy it, read it, review it, especially review it.
Review it.
I know. I am such a hypocrite. I keep meaning to buckle down and start reviewing these books, and I don't do it. I just preach to other people like a goddamn hypocrite. So I'm gonna really try to batten the hatches down and get that done. So we'll all keep each other accountable.
There you are.
Yeah. But tell me about your other works. Tell me about your short stories. Let's start with In the Presence of Gods.
Oh, In the Presence of Gods is basically an origin story told by one of the founding members. And, you know, it goes off of how they met, you know, all the problems they had and their rise to stardom. It was just something to have fun with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And what do we got next? Coin Toss?
Oh, Coin Toss. That's a gritty, I would call it a neo-noir.
See, I like the sound of that.
It's dark and depressing and doesn't get any lighter.
I imagine the ending is soul crushing.
Oh, I've had people tell me they hate me after that.
Oh. I hate you.
It's like, but it was good.
Yeah.
So is that a good kind of hate? I don't understand. You've confused me. I had one of my author friends tell me the book I'm writing on, and if you do it like coin toss at the end, mm-hmm. I will hunt you down and kill you like a dog in the street. Mm-hmm. Like, wow. Okay.
I tell you, I was thinking about this. I was at the gym earlier today, and I was listening to music, and I was listening to some dark dubstep, and somebody had sampled in Matthew McConaughey from True Detective, and I'm trying to find the exact quote. I think I found it. So imagine deep, dark dubstep. And then mm-hmm. his voice has been slowed down. So it's, you know, like that.
Yeah.
I think human consciousness is a misstep in evolution. We became too self-aware. Nature created an aspect of nature separate from itself. We are creatures that should not exist by natural law.
I love that.
And it goes through the whole quote, you know, which ends with, the solution is for us to deny our programming to procreate, walk hand in hand, brothers and sisters, into extinction, opting out of a raw deal.
And I thought I was dark.
Yeah. I mean, God, that really gets you in the noir feelies.
I bet that was a good workout after that one.
Mm-hmm. So what are we talking about? Coin toss. So neo-noir, very dark. Okay. We got Barbarian King.
Oh, Barbarian King. That came about as a rant because I heard someone, you know, basically glorifying war. Mm. And, you know.
A politician?
No. I was just kept on walking because, you know, that's not even worth talking to. I didn't have any discussion with this person. I just, you know, became enraged because, you know, I just remember my father telling me, you know, anyone who glorifies war has obviously never seen it because there is nothing glorious about it.
Mm-mm.
He goes, it is nothing but death and human suffering. Either you're inflicting it or it's being inflicted upon you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thanks, Dad. I'll remember that. And now you wonder why I write the way I do.
I couldn't imagine the smell of gore and gunpowder. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like, I bet there is an intertwining of very particular smells that combine multiple different smells that kind of congeal into this one very recognizable odor that I bet mm-hmm. people that have been in war, if they get something that even resembles it, you know, like maybe they walk past a dumpster that's got a particular methane smell that just has like hints of this battle smell. I bet it just sets them off temporarily. Like, oh, Jesus, God, you know?
Well, I asked my dad about that one time, you know, and he goes, go to the store, buy a pound of hamburger, let it sit out in the sun for a day and a half, then go sniff it.
Ugh,
you've got war.
You're just talking about, yeah, because you don't think about like, if you're in a war, I mean, sometimes bodies just have to be left to rot.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Not a fan. Well, from the description I read about your book, Coin Toss, it seems like a very gritty piece of neo-noir, and you just confirmed that. But your other short stories are a little hard for me to classify, at least based on the description. If someone asked you what genre you wrote within, what would you tell them?
I don't like to confine myself to one genre. I will write whatever is in my soul.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, this story needs to come out. And it's like, how you define it is how you define it. Like right now I'm working on I don't know if they'd call it a dark romance thriller or erotic thriller, or I don't know what people would call it yet. I'm going to have to send that out. Well, how would you define this? I need to market it. How are you going to find it?
Have you been reading Claire's work? Is that what?
Oh, Claire. I love Claire.
I love Claire. Yeah. Is that what's been influencing you to write the dark romance?
She was part of it. Yeah. Yeah. I love Claire.
Yeah. I've only read her Southern Gothic. I haven't read the femdom stuff.
Nah, I haven't read any of that yet. I have to work up to that.
Well, what is your writing atmosphere?
Oh, noir corner.
Noir corner.
Noir corner. Yeah, that's what I call it. It's
the black corner.
It is so sparse. I mean, minimalists would say you could buy a little something, couldn't you? I have my computer and my chair. And that's it.
Yeah, I mean, granted, I have a lot of electronics sitting here, but I mean, I don't have like paintings on the wall. It looks like I've got a meth lab set up. No, I'm just playing. I'm sorry. I interrupted you. Please continue.
No big deal.
I apologize.
No, that's it. I mean, I have my chair, my desk, my computer. That's my writing life.
Do you need like total quiet? Do you listen to music? Are you snorting cocaine? No, I'm just kidding.
No cocaine.
No cocaine. Kids, kids, listeners at home, don't do drugs.
Don't do drugs. Just say no.
Just don't get in the situation where you have to say no. Avoid those people.
You're going to meet them. Just say no.
Okay.
Sometimes I'll listen to music. There was a scene in the book I'm writing now. It's just like, it just wasn't coming to me. So I put on my headphones, you know, close my eyes, listen to music for a little bit. And the song In a Guided Vita came on.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just into the beat. And I was just like, oh, I could do this. And I just started typing. And I had to shuffle it back a couple times, where I think I listened to it like 8 times in a row.
Wow.
But I got an entire chapter out, you know, and I read it. Wow. Minimal editing. I love myself sometimes. Just sometimes.
My attention is just so scattered. Like when I'm writing questions for the show, I need total silence. I've told myself, oh, I can listen to music as long as it doesn't have any words, you know, just like some ambient. Yeah. Not even that. Yeah. That's still stifled. I need all of the bandwidth in my brain. I can't turf any of it out to anything else.
See, that's me usually, but every now and then it's like that song just got me going. It's like, if I lose the song, I know I'll lose my tempo.
Yeah, I can understand. Like some spontaneous inspiration that you latch onto. Yeah. But yeah, I could see that probably happening. That may have happened in the past, but you know, as a practice, like, okay, I have an episode coming up. I need to write some questions. I definitely can't have any music going. Well, is there anything you avoid because you feel that it stifles your creativity?
I will avoid science fiction like it is the plague sent from hell.
Just like reading it?
Oh, I will read it.
Okay.
I don't mind most of it. I will not write a damn thing. Because if you don't get it just right, you get those fans of sci-fi, they will rip you a new one. It's like, dude, you're an idiot. Oh my God, this is impossible. You know, it's like finding a black hole in the middle of the sun. It's like, it just doesn't exist. It's like, there's a reason it's called fiction.
So
imagine the science exists.
Yeah. So the fear of criticism almost drives you into a form of writer's block.
No, I don't care. People can hate me all they want. I don't care.
Or the fear of criticism making the work you're putting in
trivial.
Yeah, like not worth it in a sense. Like, why am I putting all this work into this if people are just going to pick it apart and say that it's not accurate? You know?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. It's like you can't write history without knowing history. And it's just like, I will agree with that. Well, you can't write science fiction unless you know science. Well, I know science and you read all that. Show me a phaser on this earth. Show me.
Well, I mean,
I want my lightsaber.
Well, so they don't like Star Wars?
No. It's just, I've seen so many fans pick the tiniest things where it's like, it doesn't quite match up to the science.
Oh.
Well, it doesn't match up to the science we have now.
Yeah. Huh. So there are people that are such purists that they want whatever is in the book, they want you to be able to produce a schematic for its construction.
Pretty much, or at least make it how it would logically work.
Okay.
It's like, I can't make it logically work. I don't know how it logically works. It doesn't exist.
I mean, I can appreciate scrupulous realism. That's one of the things I like.
Yeah.
I haven't read John Grisham in forever, but that's one of the things I love about his legal thrillers.
Oh, yeah.
The fact that he used to be a prosecutor. So, I mean, the details are all, you know.
Oh, yeah.
The scrupulous realism, and I think it's Clive Cussler I'm thinking of, all the military thrillers. So, yeah, there's something to be said for that. But, yeah, I don't know. I guess I would have to read what they're picking apart.
Yeah. I wrote a science one, you know, way back then, and it's like, I just had it torn apart. And it's like, well, I understand that, but it's still fiction.
Yeah.
Well, Chance, you need to make it kind of work. I don't care if it works.
Well, how fantastical were the things you were putting in? Let's see. Maybe I might agree with these people. What kind of shit were you coming up with?
Well, see, one of the things I did, like time travel, and it's like, yeah, the paradox. I understand the paradox. But if you understand the paradox, there's no time travel then.
Yeah. So in a sense, you don't want to cheat yourself out of having that element of a story if you're going to.
Right.
Yeah. And I don't know what you're talking about. Listeners at home, for a minute there, I was feigning like I knew what the paradox was, but I'm not even going to try and act like I'm smart. Whatever this paradox is you speak of, if that precludes time travel from being possible, wouldn't it still be okay to produce something that, even though it's not possible, just something that explains it, even if it's total BS?
Oh, yeah. But then, you know, you have to go to all the trouble of that. I just like to write.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't want to get technical. I'm not doing a technical magazine here.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine somebody like Dan Brown.
Oh, yeah.
The amount of research that guy does before he even types a single letter of his books, that would drive me nuts. I'd be like, I want to write, you know, I want to write the story.
See, I back myself into a corner a lot of times. It's like, well, I got this going on. Is this possible?
Mm-hmm.
Did this actually happen?
Yeah.
Sort of. All right. Well, it happened.
Well, do you utilize beta readers? And can you tell us a little bit about your editing process?
I will do as much editing as humanly possible before I send it out to beta readers. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I will listen to their advice with an open heart. And if it doesn't match the view I have in my head, I will ignore their advice with a closed mind.
Chance, you have to kill your darlings. You know this.
Oh, yeah, I know. You and Stephen King. Read my stuff. I've killed plenty of darlings.
Okay. Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Those poor darlings.
Well,
so do you use an editor at all?
Oh, yes. Julia Slack. I love this woman to death. She came to my rescue.
But by the time it gets to her, you've pretty much polished it as much as you can.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. What's one of the things that she most commonly comes back to you about? What's your darling that you usually have to kill?
She will tell me if things aren't flowing, you need to get rid of this paragraph. No, I don't want to. This is the only person in the history of the world has ever called me a twat. You're being a twat. Just do it. It's like, so she actually sent it back without it. And I was like, fine, I like it better.
But like, what's in the paragraph? Like, are you too descriptive? Are you?
It just didn't add to the story. You know, it's like, if it doesn't add to the story, then do you really need it?
Like a character or?
Just like, you know, you're getting a little wordy. It's like, you know, they're out in the sunshine. They're out in this. It's like, yeah, we got it. They're in the park. Let it go.
You don't need to list every article of clothing they're wearing.
Right.
Yeah. Gotcha.
The breeze is coming from the southwest at 15 miles an hour.
Partly cloudy with a 40% chance of rain.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, things like that. It's like, all right. I'll let it go.
I gotcha. Well, I see a lot of poetry on your Instagram page. Have you published or are you planning to publish a collection of poetry?
Oh, there's a lot of people that actually want me to and have required it. No, I will probably never publish any poetry. It's something I do for myself to keep me sane. It's my way of trying to step back into the light from my dark world.
Well, in a sense, you're publishing it. It's on your Instagram page.
Well, yeah, I'll give you that. But
you should just compile it.
Well, there you go. Then I had to market it and pretend I like people. And
Chance. Well, tell me about your publisher. Is it pronounced Pugpay or Pugpay?
Pugpay. Pugpay. Yep, my family came up with that. It was our dog. She was half pug, half Shar Pei. So we always called her a Pugpay.
Is that like the actual term for them, a Pugpay, or you just kind of?
Nope.
Oh, okay.
She was just a mixed breed dog. You know, she was half pug, half Shar Pei.
All right.
So it's like, I always, what kind of dog is that? She's weird. She's a Pugpay. Ooh. It's like, you know, you say she's a mutt, and then people are like, oh, okay. But she's a Pugpay, and they're like, oh, something special.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I didn't know sometimes they blend two things to make them evolutionarily better. We have a Maltipoo, which is a Maltese and a poodle, and I think what the Maltese does for the poodle is it takes away a predilection for liver cancer, I think.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But I think he's got some Jack Russell Terrier in him because he is out of his goddamn mind.
Likes to run around and dig a lot.
Oh, my God. Yeah. He's 9 years old. He's got way more energy than I do. It's exhausting. People are like, oh, how big is he going to get? I was like, no, you don't understand. He's not a puppy. He's an old
he's
man.
Not a puppy.
And he still has this much energy.
That's cool.
Well, so where do you see the format of literature evolving? Will novels remain popular or will short fiction become the norm?
I believe novels will always be popular. Whether they lose their popularity over time, it's probably a good indication. Because, you know, this younger generation, if you watch a 15-second video, it's like, well, wow, waste the last 5 seconds watching the end. It's like, it's 15 seconds. I was good with it.
See, we Gen Xers, we're turning into old men. These kids these days and their goddamn one-minute videos.
Yeah. So, but yeah, short stories, they have their place. Novels have their place. I believe there will always be novels, though.
Mm-hmm.
Whether how popular they are, I don't really know. I would hope popular.
Yeah.
This is coming from a person who just published a book with short stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Could short stories please become popular? That would be great.
Yeah. Yeah.
I could really use an uptick in book sales.
Chance needs a ticket for Rome.
Well, speaking of literature in general, which book radically altered your view of what could be accomplished with the written word?
Oh, hands down, 1984.
Bam! Mic drop.
Bam!
That's the right answer, sir.
Oh, there was so much wrong with that book. It was just like, how far can you take the human psyche and just drive it into the earth?
Yeah. I think we're about to find out.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're familiar with Neuralink, right?
Yes.
When I heard about Neuralink, what it does, the first thing that popped into my mind was thought crime.
Yep.
I was like, oh, shit. Here it comes. 1984. Fuck.
Mine, too. It's like, oh, you were eventually going to commit a crime.
Yep.
Based on what you thought about it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great what they're doing. I think from what I hear, they literally just implanted the first one to somebody that's a paraplegic. So, mm-hmm. I mean, shit, that's great. You know, make somebody that can't walk, they can walk again. I don't know if that's what the deal was, but if that's.
Yeah, I think that's what it was.
Yeah. If they haven't accomplished that now, that is the trajectory, I'm sure. And that is honorable, great. And I hope that happens. But for the love of God, I don't want to find out what else goes with it because, you know, Black Mirror hit it on the nose. Any technological advancement has great things, but there's always a downside.
There's always a downside. You know, that great technology, you got somebody, how can I use this to my advantage?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we've got a Neuralink. Now we've got a hacker.
Yeah.
Go rob a bank for me.
Yeah. Speaking of Lex Fridman again, I was listening to his show. He had on the CEO of OpenAI, which, you know, they create a lot of things, ChatGPT being one of them. And they were talking about the production of AGI, artificial general intelligence, which, you know, the AI they have right now is just based on data sets and can do complex tasks and do some reasoning. But, you know, AGI would be the shit that could learn and, you know, the science fiction scary shit. And they were talking about...
And next thing you know, you got somebody going, I'll be back.
Yeah, yeah. What was the name of that organization? Skynet, whatever?
Skynet, yeah. Yep,
oh,
Skynet.
God. So, yeah, there's another recommendation from Lex. You need to check that one out.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, if you had carte blanche to control the literary world, what would you like to see more or less of?
I'd like to see a bigger push for indie authors. I've read so many great indie authors. It's unreal. And, you know, for the most part, they're struggling. It's like, how are you struggling? This is dynamite. This is gold. I don't understand how you're struggling. You got to get people to read it.
Mm-hmm. Marketing.
Oh, yeah. Oh, now I understand it. Yeah. I would see a bigger push towards indie authors. So everybody listening out there, give indie authors a shot. You never know who's going to be your next favorite author.
What would that look like? I mean, you know, indie authors, some of them have the means to hire people to do marketing for them. But most indie authors don't have a bunch of disposable income to spend on people that do the marketing for them, or, you know, expensive Google, Facebook, or, you know, whatever ads. So they have social media at their disposal to market. But that, I mean, some of the people that I watch that are constantly putting up videos, I mean, it just makes me exhausted. It's great to see. Oh, I love seeing indie authors do that. But I'm like, okay, this person has a family, has a full-time job, writes like a prolific writer, and then just blows up social media marketing. They must be fucking exhausted.
It is. You know, it is exhausting.
So, I mean, like, what would that look like? What would be the game changer to help an indie author that's in that position kind of get some traction, I guess is what I mean.
Some traction, yeah, yeah, traction. That's a good question. If I had the answer to that question.
People would be, you'd be in a,
yeah,
you'd be in a much
people
better
be
spot.
To me.
Yeah, you wouldn't be on my pod. No, I'm just playing.
Yeah. You'd be on mine. Yeah. But I would like to see, I guess, some sort of format just specifically for indie authors, unless it exists and I don't know about it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it seems like people catch a lot of, at least the few that I know of, like Christopher Triana. I mean, obviously, Gone to See the River Man kind of put him on the map as far as writing is concerned, but he seems to really be benefiting from Substack. And I haven't seen a lot of authors utilize that. I mean, maybe there are plenty of them doing it. It's just the ones that I have had on the show and interact with on a normal basis. I haven't seen a lot of them utilize that. And I feel like that might be something that they may. And I mean, granted, that looks like it's a shitload more work, but
yeah,
maybe do a little lighter over here and a little heavier over here on Substack. I don't know. You know, that's just something I'm throwing out there.
Yeah, because I think Claire Castleberry utilizes Substack.
Mm-hmm. And again, I'm exercising a bit of hubris here, not being a writer myself. Maybe yeah. Writers listening right now, like, you have no idea what you're talking about. Shut up.
Yeah, it could be.
So, well, what is the life of Chance Noir like outside of writing?
Well, I have my family, full-time job. I like to exercise. I like to be outdoors. I love to go. I mean, absolutely, one of my favorite things to do is go rappelling. Oh, there's nothing like hanging off the side of a cliff.
Oh, okay. Rappelling. Gotcha.
Yeah, rappelling. This might be my last one.
Why?
There's no guaranteed ending.
Whoa, okay, I got you. Yeah, it's a little bit of a high risk.
You're just hoping to make it down alive.
Yeah, when you push off, you're hoping that that thing holds. You just don't go flying off the edge. Have you ever skydived?
Oh, that's on my list. That's one of the many things on my list.
Yeah, I would definitely give that a shot. I had to quit. I injured myself, but that's because I was being a little reckless. I should not have been diving in the conditions that I was. I had just started and it was way too windy for me to be diving. So my landing wasn't the most graceful thing in the world. I dislocated my shoulder.
So the safe landing was not a foregone conclusion.
No, I was like, it's just a little wind. It's no big deal. Anyway.
Well, I'm glad you had a happy ending.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's happy, but...
How's that go? Any landing you walk away from is a good
one?
Yeah,
there you go. There, yeah. Point taken. Absolutely. Well, Chance, it has been a pleasure talking with you.
Thank you. It's been great, Vince.
So as we bring the show to a close, is there anything you'd like to plug or let your readers know about?
Well, I do have my upcoming book that I still don't know how to put into a genre. It's Feral Creatures. Give it a shot when it comes out. Any book you read, give it a review.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we look forward to checking that out. So listeners at home, all links are in the description. And Chance, thank you again for joining me.
Thank you, Vince.
And thank you to everyone that tuned in. If you enjoyed today's episode, please be sure to like, share, and subscribe. Be sure to tune in next Tuesday when I will be joined by a writer that has woven a dystopian tale within a nihilist void. So until then, stay healthy, stay sane, and as always, thank you for listening. See you next time. In the end.